Pam Grier has worked with some of Hollywood's biggest stars, Paul Newman, Robert De Niro, Michael Keaton, Samuel L. Jackson. She's perhaps best known for her iconic leading roles as Coffee and Foxy Brown in blaxploitation films in the 1970s. And a chance meeting with Quentin Tarantino in 1996 led to her starring role in his movie, Jackie Brown, introducing her to a whole new generation of moviegoers. More recently, she starred as Kit Porter in Showtime's The L Word. Like her characters, Pam Grier is fiercely independent, strong-willed, and a survivor, and she writes about the journey of her life in a new memoir called Foxy, My Life in Three Acts. It was written with Andrea Kagan, and it is published by Springboard Press, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Pam Grier to our show today. Hello.
Oh, hello to you. I'm so honored to be here. This is great.
Well, I'm very pleased to meet you. The characters you play throughout your career could be considered very urban, and you come from Denver, but didn't you spend much of your childhood in the mountains of Colorado and on a farm in Wyoming? Fishing, hiking, riding horses?
So yes.
That would surprise a lot of people.
Yes, it would. My family is part of the Black West, the Underground Railroad.
Were there a lot of African Americans in
yes,
the area?
Yes, quite a few. There were black homesteads, and many of the free men had homesteaded before the emancipation. And many of the descendants were my family and friends. So I grew up riding and hunting and fishing and camping out. And my grandfather always wanted the girls to bring in the boat. If something happens to me, bring in the boat. And we always had gardens, and we always had fresh cream from cows and chickens. And so I had a urban, rural, and a military background.
Because your mother was a nurse, but your father was in the Air Force.
Mm.
Stationed in England when you were young?
Yes, yes.
And you spent some years there?
Yes, almost a little over 2 years. And what was extraordinary was the our landlady, Mrs. Lofton, and the residents of the neighborhood were so just enamored with African-American culture and music and Duke Ellington and Count Basie and dancing and music and what's going on, and that what they would see were the civil rights unrest. They would see horrible images or hear of them, and they were really concerned. And Martin Luther King, he really is a king. And they because they were bombed.
Although it is interesting,
London had war.
I went to school in London, and when I arrived, there would if you were trying to rent an apartment, it would say no colored allowed or Europeans only.
Mm-hmm.
They
mm-hmm.
had changed an awful lot in 10 years or so.
Well, we weren't in London. We were in Swindon, which was a coal mining town, and we might have been mixed race, but it was different. That culture was different. It wasn't an elite London that where we lived.
Were you aware that you were physically attractive at a young age? I mean, mm-hmm. I've always wondered about pretty good-looking kids who everybody coos over.
No. In my family, we did not have that competitive, that aesthetic, that someone's features were more attractive than someone else's. We weren't raised with that. So I didn't know that I was considered a beautiful, you know, child physically.
When did you start entering beauty pageants?
When I was in the Miss K How, it was for the radio station, one of my jobs, and they all assumed that I was just this pretty hot thing, and I did not know how to wear makeup. I needed money for tuition for school, and I thought, well, I can make a couple of $100. That would be nice. And they said, well, you are so pretty. Don't you know you're pretty? No, what do I do? And I had my swimsuit on backwards, even in the photograph.
Must have felt uncomfortable.
But it fit beautifully that way. No one knew. I'm revealing that now.
Well, you reveal a lot of stuff in this book. You write rather
yes,
candidly about some terrible traumatic things that happened to you. I assume it's because you were attractive.
Yes. I think that was one of the issues. But I think also there were gender issues where there was an entitlement of men to be a little bit more familiar with women and take it upon themselves to be, whether it was abuse and their sons would see that behavior. I think it was a very sexist world at that time, and that could have been a very big part of it also. And the things that happened to me were very traumatic, and I had no control, and I knew that my family would be in turmoil if they knew. So I kept it quiet.
So you kept it secret?
Yes, I did.
I'd imagine it was hard to write about, and I realize it's one thing to write about something like that.
Oh, my God, yes.
Another to discuss it on the air, so I'm not going to pursue this.
I drank a lot. I padded a room, and there were times when Andrea Kagan, who was wonderful, and she came to me. There were many, many other authors who offered their services to guide me and create probably one of the best, you know, literary works, because I really didn't know how I would even finish it, complete it. And she would say, Pam, okay, we need to stop. It would bother her. And then there were days when I would say, Andrea, I have to stop and I'll call you. When I, you know, come to terms, recover, maybe talk to a therapist. Because I have to revisit. I'm now revisiting those moments. And I could feel my entire body seize.
You originally were interested in medicine. Did you even consider acting at first?
No. No, but I enjoyed photography. And I thought perhaps I might be a camera person or a director. My psychology professor at Metropolitan State College, where I was going to school.
Before you went to UCLA.
Before I transferred, he said, you know, Pam, what do you really want to do? Because he knew I had several jobs. I was riding the bus in snowstorms. I was meeting every obligation, and I was really enjoying school. He said, what do you really want to do since you're putting yourself through school? I said, well, I, you know, a doctor, you know, I maybe a veterinarian. And he knew that there were only so many limited possibilities for me being a woman of color. And he said, well, what do you really want to do? I don't want you to go through life, as many people have done, doing something that other people want them to do. And I said, well, he said, don't be a doctor because someone else wants you to be. It is money and it's prestige. Do something that is passionate and it's not work. It won't be work to you. And I said, well, I love television. I love film. There were only four film schools then. I'm dating myself. Mm-hmm. Four, UCLA, USC, NYU, and Northwestern. That was it.
And they still remain among the best. So.
Well, some of the best. And I said, well, I don't know any. I don't know where to. I don't know how. He said, well, you could transfer to a place where you have relatives and you can live with them and they can help you. But I was an out-of-state student. I said, he said, well, you'd have to go to UCLA if you know anyone out there. I felt the weather was good. I could survive. No more snow. I didn't want to go back east. And we found a distant relative and they let me stay in their garage, which was fixed, decorated like a tiki lounge.
So you went to UCLA,
but you wound up acting. I couldn't get into school. I couldn't get into, I was an out-of-state student, and the classes were too high. It was cost prohibitive. So they said, but if you can become a resident, you can stay here for 2 years, live in California and survive, then you can, you know, pay the state fees, which were much, much lower. And by then, I would have immersed myself in the filmmaking industry, student filmmaking industry, and I would know if that's what I really wanted to do. And I just immersed myself, met these great film students, and it was a family of gypsies that we would, I said, I think I found a home. I think I found a place.
Well, how'd you wind up making your first film?
I was a friend. I didn't make my first film. I was an extra on a Roger Corman film. In the Philippines now. That was my first lead role for Roger Corman.
Mm-hmm.
And Roger had...
He made so many people into stars.
Yes, and they were there in those offices at that very moment, from Steven Spielberg, Francis Coppola, Jonathan Demme, Jonathan Kaplan, Jonathan Taplin, Michael Mann. I mean, we could go on and on. One of my jobs was at the Agency for the Performing Arts, and Hal Gefsky had been trying to find an actress for Roger Corman to send. He wanted an in-your-face, radical... not the same overly made-up actress, diva. He wanted someone that was representing the moment, raw and political. That was I. And Hal said, you know, Pam, would you like to be an actress? We really would like to get you out of the office, because I wouldn't lie for the agents. They would say, Pam, tell them I'm not here. And I would say, no, you do that. And they said, Pam, that's your job. So they said, we're going to get her job and get her out of the office. I'm going to fail. So Hal walks me down to Roger's office and introduces me. And we have a conversation, which I'm a part of the Black Student Movement, Kent State, Black Panthers. I'm a radical. Even though I may not look it, I have to work. I have to go somewhere else in my life, and I can't be a radical. And he said, but I like your politics, and you're raw. I'm looking for that. Would you like to be an actress? No, I don't know how to be one. Well, I think you'd be perfect for the role. Roger, I don't know how to be. I can't leave my jobs to be an actress, and then you fire me because I'm horrible. He said, I'll make sure you're not fired. So he had me get this book by Konstantin Stanislavski,
The Actor Prepares.
And I have it in my living room today.
So you actually learned by reading Stanislavski.
Yes, I did. And he said there was no such thing as a small role, and I treated these wet T-shirt roles seriously, as if it was Chekhov. And I raised the bar.
Well, you were the big dollhouse, but not in Ibsen's The Dollhouse.
Yes, it was to me. It was.
But it was the same. But they're all, those films are called blaxploitation films. Do you accept that term?
Well, the thing is, those films weren't blaxploitation. The blaxploitation came later when, after I did Black Mama, White Mama, and then I got a three-picture deal called Coffee, Foxy Brown, and Sheba, those three films. However, which is interesting, there were quite a few films done by males, black males, before mine. And they were just action movies. Same formula, same pimps and hoes, same good versus evil, same corrupt, you know, civil servants. And when I did it as a female, stepping into the male's room, stepping in the male's club, stepping into that formula, it became black exploitation, because now a female is doing it. It should have been called black exploitation long before me. I was not the vanguard. I didn't come in there waving the flag. But see, it was a gender issue, and I think people overlook that.
Well, you have been called the first woman action star, which is
by whom?
There's a harrowing yet ultimately funny story involving you on a set in Rome with a runaway horse named Donatello and
yes.
Federico Fellini. So you were really,
yes.
I mean, you were having interesting experiences.
I have. It was so wonderful to meet him. And from having a rural background, riding horses since I was a little girl, they thought, oh, Pam can be ride the lead horse, stallion. And he took off and ran through the middle of Fellini's set, and I had on a faux leopard skin and a big fro and sandals, and he said, oh, my fantasy has come true. And I said, what did that mean? I didn't want to insult him.
Well, how did you must have felt odd. Here you are, a girl who was the daughter of a nurse and a non-commissioned officer in the Air Force, hanging out with John Lennon, dating, before he became Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Lou Alcindor, Freddie Prinze. You were friends with Richard Pryor. And is it true that you helped him learn how to read? Richard Pryor, one of
yes.
the smartest men ever?
Yes. Richard had a sixth grade education, and a lot of people didn't know that. And he was ashamed of it. And he said, I want to learn how to read. And I want to be able to read, you know, War and Peace. I hear that. That's one MF book to read. And he would learn his words phonetically, and he would have someone coach him. And he could not spell. He was dyslexic, and he couldn't read. And he really, that was his passion. So I would read to him, and I would bring books because I would love reading. I'm an artful reader, whether it's a minimalist or maximalist or lyrical F. Scott Fitzgerald or Hemingway. He loved Hemingway. He loved The Old Man and the Sea, and he just wished I could read it. And I gave him that. And I also I don't know, with this affinity towards comedians, but I made him laugh when I put his injured horse in the backseat of my Jaguar and took it to the vet. He thought I was crazy. I'm crazier than Richard, and I did it. But yes, and also regarding Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, he had just embraced Islam for a couple of years.
He wanted you to convert.
Well, he did, but he also was new at it and had only given me a very short time and several books on the Quran and how to become a Muslim woman. But the real issue was that as we're exploring Islam today, Islam is not a monolithic community. It's diverse. There is diversity. And there are moderates, there's conservatives, there's fundamentalists, there's radicals. And he didn't have a direction for me. And for me to give up my freedom in the middle of the women's movement now, I am now waving the flag, burning my bra. I have to walk behind him, you know, in a burqa with braless, perhaps. I don't know how I'm going to do this. But he didn't have a plan. I just couldn't give him my life without a plan.
We have very little time left, but I want to know how you wound up working for Quentin Tarantino, who had just revived John Travolta's career with Pulp Fiction.
Right, right. Well, he was writing, he said, I saw him in the street one day in California, and he was standing in the street flirting with a woman in a car ahead of us, and he said, Pam Grier, Pam Grier, oh my God. And Warrington Hedlund, who was sitting next to me, said, that's Quentin Tarantino. I said, Pulp Fiction? And he comes over and he says, I'm writing a movie for you. I'm going, sure, right.
Says, and he was writing it for you with you in mind without having talked to you about it?
He was writing it for me and hoping I would like it. And he invested 2 years of his life to do so. And when he sent it to me, it was due 44 cents and had been at the post office for 3 weeks. And they kept sending me these yellow tags and I kept sending them back saying, who doesn't have 44 cents? So I get it and I read it. And I said, well, which role am I? I call him. I said, Quentin, I read it. He was about to pass on it. He was waiting. He thought I didn't like it. And I said, I love it. It's like Pulp Fiction. Your story is phenomenal. And I was so honored.
It was a fabulous film.
It was I owe him at least one child. At least one. Maybe two, a boy and a girl. I don't know. But because of it, I'm now working with Tom Hanks. And I played Julia Roberts' best friend in a movie I just flew in from. And Quentin, Lifeline. People have just given me lifelines for my career.
Well, after that, we had the L Word, which just stopped filming. But
yes.
That was another wonderful stop in your career.
Yes.
Unfortunately, we can't get to any more of that. But I do want people to know that Pam Grier will be signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store in Tribeca at 97 Warren Street. Her book is called Foxy, a memoir, My Life in Three Acts, written with the help of Andrea Kagan. And I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, giving me this moment to share with you.
I was the third brother of five, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying.